go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Annis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Arden Zwelling. Lots to get to today. We will get to the races for the playoffs in the National Hockey League. Raptors clinching the Atlantic Division with a win over the hapless Lakers yesterday. Lots of NFL stuff to get to as well. Michael Sam looks like he could be headed to the CFL. Oh, and the Masters are approaching. So maybe we'll talk about the prospect of Tiger Woods making his return at Augusta. But we start with the Toronto Blue Jays because it was minus 16 with the wind chill this morning, so why not talk about baseball? Blue Jays with a little split squad action. You can watch them on Sportsnet, hear them on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, 12:30 today at home against the Atlanta Braves. Marco Estrada will get the start. Miguel Castro and Roberto Osuna to appear in this game after yesterday's rain-shortened victory. So that's interesting. So that's going to be interesting watching. Jordan, these two 20-something-year-olds, Castro and Osuna. Barely 20-something. Castro looks like a lock to make this team, and Osuna now seems like he's headed down that path as well. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? How should we feel about this?
I think if you're a fan, it's a good thing because you like to dream on it, especially in late March, especially when you watched poor Marcus Stroman go down and the feelings start to get a little crushed and you start to worry this is going to be a season loss before it begins. So you need guys like that. Nobody's getting excited if you told me that Steve Delabar and Aaron Loop are pitching today.
People would find a way to get excited. I mean, that's kind of the nature of March baseball, early April baseball, is that everybody's excited. The Houston Astros are excited right now, Arden.
I'm excited that Randy Wolf is pitching today in the other side of the split squad.
We don't get to watch him, though.
The triumphant return. You guys aren't carrying that one? That's the game.
That's the game. One. It's funny to look at the discrepancy between the two lineups and the two starting pitchers. Well, not that Marco Estrada is going to be part of this starting five, but yeah, I think the good team is starting at home and on television and on radio.
Triumphant return. This like 38-year-old guy who's like, no, I still got it. I'm going to do this. Well, the game has tried to pass him by, and he's like, no, I'm doing this.
Will the Wolf Pack be there? Do you think there'll be guys all decked out in their Wolf attire?
That's where I'm going after this, bud. What do you think I'm doing today? Flying down
to go see Randy Wolf.
Can't you just put on your wolf ears and sit in front of the TV?
I am hungry like a wolf for the Randy Wolf.
Yeah. So Randy Wolf will pitch in the other split squad game as Arden tries to derail the conversation about Miguel Castro and Roberto Osuna. Where do you stand with those dudes?
What do you want me to say about these? I mean, they're coming north. They're on the team.
I want you to say they're going to save the season.
I mean, you saw them in person.
I did see them. Miguel Castro was far more impressive. I feel like I saw the worst of Roberto Osuna. Every time I saw him, he was getting hit. But, I mean, they see something that they like. I've seen him get barreled up. That's just what I've seen, but I mean, that's very selective. You know, he hasn't allowed an earned run this spring. I mean, he's walked two guys, struck out eight and nine and two thirds. I mean, he's looked fine. The velocity's there. It'll be the off-speed stuff for him because he's coming back from Tommy John, and that's often the last thing to come back when you come back from Tommy John, because the off-speed, you need to be prorating that wrist, and you're getting the turn and the spin and putting hitches and things, and that can, you know, put a lot of stress on your elbow. So that we'll see. I mean, I don't know. Are you sacrificing a lot of development by having him in the majors, well, pitching out of the bullpen?
Do you think that this is the kind of move that gets made when you have a front office that's feeling the pressure to do it this year, or they might not be around?
I mean, it's the opening day roster, though, right? Like, the bullpen might look different by the time they come back home for the home opener, right? Well, like, you don't know.
What are the options outside of them? I mean, there's Steve Delabar, and then what else? I mean, what if it's not Steve Delabar, who's that other guy that they could have thrown in there?
I mean, there's going to be a Jeff Francis. It could have been.
Neat. Oh, great.
I knew you were going to say that. I don't know.
Hey, you can't hate on Jeff Francis.
I mean, if you're ripping on Randy Wolf's noodle arm.
I'm not ripping on it. I'm excited.
So how can you be excited about Randy Wolf but not Jeff Francis?
Where's
your patriotism?
Yeah, I mean, there's a Jeff Francis. There's, they could have been a Kyle Drabek if they had kept him. I mean, they just seemed to sour on him completely. But, I mean, he was an out-of-options guy. You could have optioned Osuna and brought Drabek. I mean, if we're talking about like a sixth, seventh guy in the bullpen anyway, I mean, you know, if you're getting to these kids after, you know, you go through your prime guys.
But is it like, because you have Osuna as a sixth or seventh guy in the bullpen, isn't it more likely that Delabar or Drabek or whoever would be the sixth or seventh guy, but they see a little bit more in Osuna that he doesn't have to be that end of the bullpen?
Yeah, I mean, sure. How important are these first six, seven games? Are they that important? Maybe they are.
Yes, they're incredibly important.
Okay.
Every game
is equally important.
But I don't know if I'm convinced that Osuna is going to be a sixth, seventh guy out of the bullpen, because you have already a couple of mop-up guys in Todd Redmond and the guy who's starting today in Marco Estrada. So to me, Aaron Loop is the first lefty out of the bullpen, and then Colt Hines or whatever is the second lefty. And I know Stephen Brunt has raised the possibility of Castro eventually taking over the closer's spot as early as May. I could see it too. But, I mean, where does Osuna end up in this bullpen? I don't think it's six or seven. It might be, you know, the second righty out. It might be, you know, Brett Cecil's your closer. Castro immediately is your eighth inning setup man. And Osuna's your second righty outside of Castro.
The thing about Estrada and Redmond is they're both doing the same job right now. And I think if Todd Redmond's coming north, he's your mop-up man, he's your long man. I think Marco Estrada maybe gets converted into a one-inning righty guy. And maybe he becomes a max effort dude. So he's, instead of him tossing up those like 89 mile an hour fastballs up in the zone at the Rogers Center, he becomes a max effort guy, gets it up to 90, 91, which plays a bit better. And he's a guy who, like, when he misses, he really misses, right? So he's a guy who's better in short bursts. I could see Estrada being turned into kind of a high leverage guy.
There's so many moving parts in this bullpen. Are we really sure that Aaron Sanchez is not going to end up back in the bullpen at some point?
I mean, we can't be sure of that. No, we can't be sure of anything. He might fall off the face of the earth. I don't know.
Might get swallowed.
He has. I mean, he has looked good as a starter here in spring training. He's done everything you expected him to do. Induce pretty weak contact with the sinker ball. He hasn't struck out guys. I mean, he's not a strikeout guy. Daniel Norris has struck out guys.
Yes,
as a reliever.
Now he's a ground ball guy.
But I mean,
Burley's gotten to these kids. Him and even Stroman before he went down became these like little sinker ball or ground ball dudes.
Well, let's be fair though. That was always Sanchez's deal. You know,
he was a strikeout guy in the minors. He was not a high
strikeout guy.
That's why he was walking so many guys in the minors, is because he was working so deep into counts, and you know, he was really like trying to backdoor guys and big curveballs and this and that. He was big out pitch guy. That's why he didn't strike it. He walked so many guys in the minors. He went deep into counts because of that.
Well, look, if you got these young arms that you're relying on to pitch, and now they've said that there's no innings limit on them, then you want them throwing ground ball outs because you want as few pitches as possible on those arms so they last longer.
Yeah.
Let's be fair. This bullpen last year was rancid because it walked everybody. Mm-hmm. It issued a tremendous number of free passes. And if you're looking at young pitching and you're trying to evaluate and you're trying to figure how that stuff and how their arms play in the major leagues, part of it as well is looking at the walk rate. And those guys have been pretty good. Castro and Osuna, I think Osuna's the only guy that's issued walks, and he's issued two in over now nine innings this spring. I mean, that's a good sign at least, Arden.
Gibby wants you to throw strikes.
Well, every manager wants you to throw strikes. That was a horrible Gibby impression, by the way.
That was pretty bad.
Everybody does a Gibby impression, and that's among the worst I've ever heard.
We lack it. We lack it.
All right, man.
Yeah, throw strikes. I don't know. That's it, man. What you want out of a bullpen. I don't know. Go ahead.
But Jordan was, I mean, he mentioned something that's interesting, and it's kind of the underlying part of this, and we can tie it into the Shai Davidi piece that is also interesting on sportsnet.ca about the Blue Jays apparently changing their philosophy when it comes to young pitching. You mentioned, Jordan, that maybe this smacks of desperation for a guy in Alex Anthopoulos and John Gibbons, who know if they don't make the playoffs, they're gone. Although we said that last year, and here we are, and they're back with this team. But yes, it certainly seems that way. Is the way they handle young pitching and the fact that they're not beholden to these 20% rules anymore, and there's no innings limit. There's no innings cap on any of these young pitchers. Even guys coming off Tommy John surgery, is that also part of the desperation?
Yeah, well, I don't know. One of the things that Anthopoulos was saying in Davidi's piece is that whatever they've done, whatever the Blue Jays have done, whatever the prevailing wisdom in baseball is, nothing's really seemed to stop this epidemic or help it in any meaningful way. There's no numbers that sort of show you that innings limits work or, you know, not rushing a guy back is going to protect his arm. It's just young guys throw pitches and sometimes their elbow goes and sometimes it doesn't. So with that in mind, you know, you sort of you play it day to day. You make sure they're checking in with the trainers. You make sure they're feeling good. And beyond that, it's like any sport. Beyond that, you do what you can to prepare, and it's out of your control if a guy gets hurt.
Arden, do you agree with that? I mean, do you just throw your hands up and say, these guys' arms are going to blow up eventually? Might as well get the most we can out of them right now.
Pitching's an unnatural thing. Like, the human body is not supposed to, every 5 days, 100 max effort pitches, not supposed to happen. You're going to blow out your elbow doing that. Like, you see the studies that it's, like, miraculous that they don't blow out their elbow or their shoulder on every single pitch. Just the amount of force and tension and torque that are on these. You look at it, like, especially, like, the guys like Castro or, like, the Chris Sale types, like, the really whippy guys. Like, it's unnatural what they do. So, I don't know. Like, there just isn't enough empirical data to say this is the way to do it or this is not the way to do it.
Well, I mean, you look at the Jabba rules. Jabba Chamberlain, when he first came up with the Yankees, how they put so many restrictions on when he could pitch, how often he could pitch, and how many innings at a time. And, I mean, he still needed Tommy John surgery. Everybody needs it. Everybody has elbow issues, if not shoulder issues, which are much worse. But I don't know. Obviously, you'd like to protect these guys, especially one coming off Tommy John surgery. I just don't know if there's anything you can do.
We frame the discussion in the sense of, like, does Alex Anthopoulos make these desperation moves? Does he have to do this year to save his job? I think he also has a responsibility to a young man's career, though, to not force somebody into a situation that could hurt them down the road.
Is that what he's doing?
He also has a responsibility to the franchise to not, like, just submarine the future development of the franchise. And I think he takes those responsibilities pretty seriously.
I do, too. I wouldn't say that this stuff smacks. I've said, you know, desperation, sure, maybe you're bringing all these young guys north because you're worried about your job. Maybe you're making moves to acquire guys mid-season because you're worried about your job. I don't think he would see it that way. He'd see it as they got a shot. But especially the innings limit, that's not a desperation move. That's a, like, we don't know crap about what this does and what brings it on, so we might as well just take it as it goes.
Come on. I mean, it's not desperate that you've got two young 20-year-old pitchers who are going to make their major league debut who have not seen baseball outside of A-ball.
It's not desperation. It's the fact that you've got holes in your lineup, and these are the best guys in your organization to fill them.
Yeah, and that's a pretty desperate situation to be in, that they are the best guys. I'm not arguing with you in that respect.
Desperation. The argument we're having here is about desperation to save his job. I don't think it's a desperation move to save Alex Anthopoulos' job. If you want to call it desperation in that the way the organization is built right now, they're in desperate straits in terms of not having enough major league arms. That's a different thing.
I don't know. I feel like they do feel that they are desperate to win games early in the season. If maybe there wasn't that pressure on, maybe Steve Delabar makes this team. Maybe you wait a couple of weeks. Maybe you have Roberto Osuna go down back to Dunedin because he's probably not going to New Hampshire because it's still cold. Maybe you have him throw a couple of innings and you see if he can maintain that. And then you have him throw a little bit in New Hampshire when the weather gets a little warmer. And then you bring him up in May or something.
Look, I'm not a fan of any of this. You take the best guys who are making the roster. These guys pitched their way onto the team. He pitched better than Steve Delabar, so he's on the roster.
And as much as it all looks great and they performed well in spring training, man, lots of careers have been, you know, a lot of guys have looked good in March. A lot of pitchers have looked good in March.
Man, I hate this stuff, though, when you're looking at a roster of players and you're being like, well, this guy's played extremely well, but here are the following reasons that he can't play for our team. It's the same thing with poor Chris Bryan, who's going to spend 2 weeks in the minors because he's a good player, but they don't want to start a service clock. I understand the gamesmanship behind it, but it's crappy for these kids who have played their way onto the team and then get told, you know, see you later.
I'm not saying it's impossible that both guys could perform and perform well. Maybe they will. I have no reason to think that they won't.
Well, they have so far.
But the thing is, there's nothing to base that decision on. I know, you know, 9 innings in spring training, is that enough to base your decision that Roberto Osuna is gonna be a high leverage reliever on this team, Arden?
No.
Right.
But if those innings were better than Delabar's, then why not?
You know what, Steve?
Does he deserve a chance?
Steve Delabar has done it against major leaguers.
How did he do last year?
Not so great. He was an all-star 2 years ago, and maybe, you know, that's part of the life of a reliever in Major League Baseball as well, is that there's ups and downs, and one good year does not mean you're going to have a great year the next. It's just small sample size stuff, and maybe part of it was Delabar's velocity went down a little bit last year. I don't know. I'm of two minds because, yes, it all looks great, and they look so sexy when they pitch, you know, when they're throwing 100 miles an hour and both guys can control their changeups. I mean, when you can do like a 15-mile-an-hour discrepancy between your fastball and your changeup and you're getting huge swings and misses, that looks great. I just wonder, for a team that is playoffs or bust this year, you want to hang your hat on so many unproven guys: Castro, Osuna, Devin Travis, Aaron Sanchez, Daniel Norris, Dalton Pompey. All of those guys are going to be asked to play big, big roles on this team immediately, Arden.
The difference between like a Steve Delabar, Roberto Osuna, Miguel Castro, I mean, whether you're 20 or you're 30 or you're whatever, your stuff will be this, like, your stuff is your stuff. That's your ability. And you have that in a controlled environment. Like spring training, you can execute your stuff and it can look great because there's no stress. There's very little pressure. Guys aren't trying. You're in Florida. It's great. Once you get to the majors and you're at Yankee Stadium on opening weekend or opening during the week, whenever it is, that's a lot different. And how a guy responds to that, you can have the best stuff in the world, but if your heart rate's going and you start speeding up your delivery, maybe you start flying open, maybe you start overthrowing, you start missing your spots.
And we have no idea.
Those are the minute differences. And that's why, like, it is scary to go with a guy who's never been in a situation like that because you don't know how he'll respond to it. Because that's where the differences come.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I'm not, by no means am I, you know, saying on the radio that Osuna's going to be great and Castro's going to be great, everything's going to be fine. Don't worry. You should worry. But if they've pitched well enough to be given that chance, then they should get that chance. I mean, there is absolutely, like you say, he's not out of options. There's absolutely nothing stopping them if he can't handle that pressure from sending him back to Buffalo and bringing back Steve Delabar, who, to my mind, has proven not much more than that.
The point I'd make is that it's almost riskier to go with a guy who maybe has a bit better stuff but has never been in that situation, has never had to respond to it. You don't know what's going to happen to his mechanics.
Yep.
You don't know what, you know what I mean? Like a small mental thing, a small change of pace. You know, maybe you shake off Russell Martin to a different pitch that you should be, you know what I mean? Marcus Stroman was doing that at the beginning of last year. He's shaking off De'Aaron Navarro. It wasn't going well for him. Once he started kind of throwing what De'Aaron wanted, it was different.
Drew Hutchison goes 7 2/3 on a week from Monday in Yankee Stadium. In comes Roberto Osuna, game-tying solo shot off the bat of Mark Teixeira. How is he going to react? Right. We have no idea. And that's, I mean, you're throwing him right into the fire because he's going to be that righty setup man. I mean, Todd Redman?
If in that situation his adrenaline's going, he starts overthrowing, then his stuff decreases to below where Steve Delabar's is. And if Steve Delabar's a guy who's been in that situation before and you can count on to not rattle and to keep his metal and to execute his mechanics, that makes Steve Delabar actually above of Osuna in terms of ability.
I agree with all that, and there's so many unknowns. I will say, though, that as much of a different atmosphere as it will be at Yankee Stadium for all these young pitchers, there's a lot of pressure on them in spring training. And I'm sure, you know, that's been kind of a high heart rate thing on television, like they will be today, and in a situation where they know their dreams are so close, and it is all performance-based for them this spring.
In general, with closers and goalies in hockey and quarterbacks in football and guys who have a lot of raw talent who are going to be put in extremely high-pressure situations, in general, I am a fan of throwing those guys into the fire because their whole career is going to be spent in the fire, so you want to figure it out.
Yeah, and in the NFL, it's a little different, especially with a quarterback. I mean, you played in front of 100,000 people in college. And you know, Roberto Osuna was a professional at 16 in Mexico.
Pitching is just such a precise thing, too. Yeah, it's so precise. The smallest little, even where you land with your foot, you know what I mean? The smallest little follow-through thing, that can affect your command. And things can snowball really fast. Whereas if you're a linebacker, it's, you know, tackling's tackling.
You know, if you're a quarterback, that's the exact same thing, right? Mechanics, drops, all that kind of stuff.
It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Arden Zwelling. So we just spent 20 minutes talking about Roberto Osuna and Miguel Castro, which is kind of cool. It is definitely one of the more intriguing things to come out of spring training. There's so many other things, though. I mean, Stephen Brunt, he's been covering this team for 20 years, and it said this is one of the most interesting, intriguing spring trainings he can ever remember.
Something happens every day. Every day something happens.
Something,
it's insane.
Yeah. And the narrative changes and the discussions change. And it really is intriguing. I mean, all those young guys that looks like are going to come north with this team. Am I right? I mean, you were down there. Are all those guys going to make the... Okay, Castro and Osuna, it seems like that's correct. Devin Travis, has he made this team? I know he started 0-11, then went crazy, and then he's now slumped the last couple of times out.
I think that with Saunders starting the year on the DL, you do take Travis as your starting second baseman because you need Steve Tolleson to cover in left, right, probably not center, but who knows, like as your fourth outfielder. So you take Travis and Goins as your middle infield and Tolleson. So you take, instead of that, what that competition for second base, which is between Travis, Goins, and Tolleson, now they all come north. And then after a week, when Saunders is coming back, maybe you adjust from there. And it could be a Goins getting optioned out. It could be a Travis. I don't think it'll be a Tolleson unless they think they can sneak him through.
Yeah.
And somebody won't pick him up.
He can see now, so that's good.
Right.
And he's always hit lefties.
I like the him and Goins platoon. It's not that bad.
It's not horrible. Well, I don't know.
Goins isn't like great, but you can hide him, right? But
I don't know. Can you?
But Goins like gives you cover. It. Who else is going
to
be your backup shortstop?
Oh no, he has.
Who's your backup
team?
Third baseman?
He
right?
has to make.
You
it
need
team.
A backup shortstop on this team because we know Reyes isn't playing 162.
Right. Well, I mean, you need a backup shortstop on every team. But yeah, he's a lock to make this team, and his defense plays anywhere.
Right.
Absolutely. Okay, so as much as you know, the relievers and Castro and Osuna, you know, they played their way onto this team. The competition was great for them. The competition for that first baseman, starting first base, was a job available on this team. It hasn't gone so well. Justin Smoke has hit some home runs recently. Hasn't looked like a world beater by any stretch of the imagination. I was kind of hoping that Derek Barton would look a little better. He's playing in that split squad game, not the one that you can watch on TV today. So I don't know what his prospects are for making this team. It seems like Smoke is going to make this team. I think they like his defense. I mean, can you have a guy who you just like his defense at first base?
Oh, well, he's got D and pop, and that's about all he brings. And those aren't terrible qualities for a first baseman.
Blue Jays didn't value first base defense for a long time.
Yeah.
And this year that changed somewhere. And it makes sense with, you know, Jose Reyes had some trouble with his shoulder last year, some wild throws. Josh Donaldson isn't the best throwing third baseman. So, you know, he can help. Like, he can help kind of suck up some of those errant throws. He's a guy who takes some walks, Justin Smoke. He's a guy who you need him hitting against righties as a left-handed bat in that lineup, I think. Like, he's hit better from that side of the plate. If you want to use him to break up some of the righties or whatever you want to do, you can use him that way. He's a guy who could hit 25 to 30 bombs at Rogers Center just because he has that power, and he takes walks.
This team is going to mash lefties, it looks like.
Yeah, absolutely.
They need left-handed bats to counteract the righties.
Yeah.
And
been the same for a while.
Well, and it's not like, you know, Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista can't hit righties as well, but there's a lot of righty bats on this team, so I guess that helps break it up a little bit.
Use Saunders as a lefty bat in there, Smoke. I mean, Ryan Goins, right?
I don't know why you're so high on Ryan Goins.
Between Ryan Goins and Randy Wolf, we've got quite a fan club going.
Yeah, I mean, but Justin Smoke, like, hits righty as well, and you can use him that way. I mean, he's not like one of these guys that Toronto fans are going to love because he's not like a max effort, lay it all on the line kind of guy. Like, he has that vibe about him that people aren't going to, he's got a very Colby Rasmus vibe.
He's no
vibe.
John McDonald is what
you're
saying.
There's a very Rasmus vibe, and I feel like people are going to sour on him if he slumps.
Yes.
But I think that he will, like, he'll have a lot of power in that ballpark.
And he's going to take some big swings and miss a lot of baseballs.
And if he can take some walks and get on base, like, I'm okay with that. The low batting average, high OBP, kind of Adam Dunn sort of thing.
Like, oh, that's... Man, yeah.
It's a valuable piece. I mean, if you play it, right? My favorite thing about Justin Smoke this spring was Gare Joyce, one of our writers, was down there writing a story about basically Smoke's kind of on his last chance here in the big leagues, the same way that Encarnacion was at one point. And so Gare was trying to figure out if there was anything that Smoke was going to try to learn from Edwin. And basically he went through this whole thing with Edwin talking about what he did, how he learned to give max effort every time and all this stuff, and then asked Smoke about it. And Smoke was like, nah. I'm just going to do what I do.
Well, you look at his spring line, his batting average. This is in 46 play appearances. 184 batting average, 773 OPS.
Yeah.
That's like, hard to do. Right? That's a
not
hard stat.
Easy. That means it's home runs and it's three true outcomes. Home runs, walks, and outs. That's it.
Yeah.
You got to watch guys like that anyway. It's entertaining for TV viewers.
Yeah, he has been much worse against lefties throughout his career as well. He's not going to be asked to carry the load. Against lefties, you would think Danny Valencia is going to be probably the platoon first baseman with him.
Absolutely.
Who will face the lefties. So the
that's fine. Valencia crushes lefties. That's, well,
they
I'm
do
fine
have.
With that. Yeah.
This team is full of lefty mashers, though. Yeah, yeah, they're not going to have problems with lefties, we think. So the three catchers are still here. Josh Tolley has not been farmed out yet to minor league camp. They haven't said whether or not Russell Martin, they're happy with the job he's done with R.I. Dickey. He was, I watched a bit of the broadcast. I guess it was last week Dickey threw to Martin, and it was on Sportsnet. Either it was last week or a couple of weeks ago. Looked fine to me. Missed a couple of balls. You know, Josh Tolley didn't catch every single R.A. Dickey knuckleball either.
Russell Martin's a pro.
Yeah, he's
a pro's pro. He could catch a knuckleball.
Said like a true Gibby over here. Yeah.
He could catch a knuckleball.
Speaking that Gibby ease.
You're both horrible with your Dickey, or with your Gibbons impressions.
We lack it.
Actually, that was better.
No, we don't lack it.
All right, so is Tolley in AAA to start the season? Because if he's on this team, man, that hurts your bench a whole lot.
Yeah, I think he is until however the Navarro situation kind of resolves itself, right? Because like right now, if you're taking Goins and Tolleson and Valencia, you only got one more spot on your bench. So what you got, you can't take everybody. So it's either Navarro or Tolley in that situation. And it has to be Navarro because Tolley has options. And that's it. No matter what R.A. Dickey wants. I mean, he's been throwing to Russell Martin all spring. Who knows? Maybe it's different when he's thrown to him at Yankee Stadium. We'll see.
Why then, last couple of weeks, kept hearing rumblings about how, oh, Josh Tolley has to be on this team. You know, R.A. Dickey has to throw to Josh Tolley. I mean, I thought he did a fine job, but I was surprised. I'm reading too much into Twitter and yeah. the conversations. And Joe Siddle, you know, keeps saying on the pregame show that, yeah, he wants Tolley and Dickey. I mean, it's a different thing. And maybe there's like a physical toll that it can play on you if you're Russell Martin and you have to be, you know, so focused on catching this knuckleball every fifth day.
I do think it's silly to make Russell Martin catch R.A. Dickey, just in terms of what the mental and physical toll, like already what you're paying him.
See,
already.
You believe that. That
to
is
live
a thing.
Up to it. No, well, I don't think that Josh Tolley has to catch R.A. Dickey, but I do think making Russell Martin do it is maybe a little bit foolish.
Well, Deonner Navarro can't do it, I guess.
Deonner Navarro definitely can't do it. He can't catch regular pitching.
Right.
So you brought Russell Martin in to live up to the offensive numbers that he put up last year. That's what you paid him for, and he's going to regress.
You paid him
he's
for pitch framing what, and all those value
you paid him for those
breaks.
Offensive. If he didn't have a 400 OBP last year and almost a 300 batting average, you don't pay nearly as much.
I don't
give him 5 years.
I don't think they're going to be shocked if he regresses
I don't think
from
be shocked,
that.
But he's already got that expectation. He's
and
already,
according to everything I've read, they're actually paying him to be, you know, a leader in the clubhouse.
Right.
Blah,
okay,
blah,
so
blah,
there's
blah.
Another thing that they're paying him for, right? They're paying him to turn around the pitch framing of this team as well, to be a better receiver than Deonner Navarro, to work with young pitchers, to harness this pitching staff, to be much better behind the plate, call a better game. Oh, and by the way, we got this guy who throws like this little trick pitch. If you could just like learn how to catch that, if you could just have these things like bouncing off your shoulders and your knees all year and just totally change your mechanics behind the plate and how you catch the ball, if you could also do that. It doesn't, you know what I mean? And it was nice to have that little built-in day off where Dickey would throw to whoever he throws to, and then the starting catcher would get the other 4 days. And now you do it with Navarro and Burley, right? That's how you kind of build in that day off. But it's a lot to ask of a guy.
It's not the worst thing in the world, though, to have Navarro as your backup catcher.
No, I think it's better than Josh Tolley, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly offensively.
Yes.
And Tolley's not exactly a defensive whiz outside of catching R.A. Dickey.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a great arm. He's fine, probably better than Deonner Navarro. So it's not a horrible situation if you have to go to war with Navarro, and he will get his at-bats, even if he is the backup catcher, whether it's DH or whatever.
It's ideal that Deonner Navarro is your backup catcher. And so he's a great, like, Deonner Navarro's bat is great for a backup catcher in terms of, like, how backup catchers perform across the league. Yeah, that's great. You'll definitely take that. I mean, I just, you know, it's a pro, just R.A. Dickey on the roster is just a problem. Like,
R.A. Dickey has this great way of making his desires known, and you always hear, oh, the rumblings say this. Yeah, the rumblings that are coming from R.A. Dickey.
Yeah,
exactly. And he more than any other player on this team, he has this way of,
he needs his binky.
Yeah, he needs his security blanket, and when his security blanket is gone, then he's got a whole bunch of excuses. And I'm not saying this as a Dickey hater. I like what he brings to the table as a solid, like, 12 win a year, you know, 200 innings guy, but just the constant, like, whining.
Yeah, I mean, I want to go back to what you said about Dickey, though, about how he is a problem. And I know you weren't saying
that.
Yeah,
I shouldn't have phrased it that way. It creates, you kind of have to find solutions, right? You have to get creative when R.A. Dickey's on your roster. I don't think he's a problem. I think that you just need to kind of be creative in the way that you build your roster around him, because you need somebody who can catch his pitch. And and that roster spot is you, like, that has a domino effect on other spots on the team.
Before we wrap up the Jays conversation, Kyle Drabek now gone, his tenure over with the Blue Jays, claimed by the White Sox, so they tried to sneak him through waivers and send him back down to AAA. He's out of options. So another piece of the Roy Halladay trade is gone. He was traded along with Travis d'Arnaud and Michael Taylor, who eventually turned into Brett Wallace, who eventually turned into Anthony Gose. Those are the three pieces from the Phillies for Halladay. How's that looked in retrospect? I mean, you Mike Wilner wrote a piece on Sportsnet.ca as well about, you know, veteran ace pitchers being traded when they had to be traded. Johan Santana. I mean, they got Carlos Gomez and Philip Umber back, and Umber threw a perfect game, just not with the Twins. And Carlos Gomez is good, just not with the Twins. I mean, CC Sabathia, you got Matt Laporta, who turned into nothing. You don't normally get a whole bunch when you're trading an ace starting pitcher. So at least there is something to show for that Roy Halladay trade, I guess.
It's prospects. If you look at it, Kyle Drabek, the year before he reached the majors, was the number 14 ranked prospect by Baseball Prospectus. Number 14. This year, Daniel Norris, the best pitching prospect on the Toronto Blue Jays staff, year before he reaches the majors, this year, number 34.
Yeah.
He's 20 spots below where Kyle Drabek was ranked. So Kyle Drabek was ranked as being that much better. I mean, it happens, man. It's like the stock market with pitchers, and especially with prospects. It's, you don't know. You can't.
And they got a bunch of chips. They got a few chips in that deal, and then they didn't fall right. You know, what are you going to do? Like, I don't think at the time anybody looked at that deal and said, this is a terrible trade, right? And even when you look at how it turned out, it wasn't terrible. But you've just got to kind of, if you're committed to dealing that ace, then you just got to take the best thing you can get and hope for the best with development.
Well, and they used d'Arnaud along with Syndergaard and Nicolino to get R.A. Dickey, and they used Taylor to eventually get Devin Travis, who's going to be their starting second baseman. So it's not a total wash for the Toronto Blue Jays. When we come back, we'll get into the NHL and how things shape up here as we head down the final straightaway in the regular season. The Hamburglar has a bit of a hiccup against the Rangers. How does that affect their prospects? Still in pole position, but long way to go. And the Oilers creeping up on the Maple Leafs as well as we look ahead to mid-April and that NHL draft lottery on April 18th. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Annis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Arden Zwelling on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's on Sportsnet.ca right now, here's John Gregg.
It's that time of year again. Spring has sprung, or will soon. The birds are chirping, and if you listen real close, you can hear the crack of the bat and called third strikes. That's right, it's baseball season. Last issue, we brought you the Blue Jays special. This time, it's our MLB preview. How far can Russell carry those Jays? Can Manny Machado stay healthy? Who's the most underrated player in baseball? And is the arms race already over? All that and more as we answer the questions that will define this Major League Baseball season.
Fans can find this story and more on Sportsnet.ca, Canada's home for sports news, analysis, videos, and features.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Arden Zwelling. About seven games to go in the NHL's regular season, and still lots to play for those final wildcard spots in both the Eastern and Western Conference. In the East, the Ottawa Senators continue to be the story of the late season here. Andrew Hammond a little banged up and got shelled against a pretty good team, and maybe the best in all of the Eastern Conference, the New York Rangers the other day. But Senators still in pole position. They are tied on points with the Bruins at 85, and the Senators have a game in hand, and they get another game against the Maple Leafs, which is always well and good. But nothing's done, and the Panthers aren't totally out of it either. They're only 3 points back, and they've got a couple left against the Bruins and one against the Senators, I believe, as well. How do we handicap this one, guys? Jordan, when we look at the Senators, it's been incredible their last couple of weeks, 3 weeks, and Hamburglar, it's, you know, burgers and pickles flying everywhere. That's fun. The Bruins have really stunk, though, too. I mean, they've lost six straight. They played into this a big portion.
Bruins have had problems. Bruins are in a tough spot right now because they've got an aging core, not too old, but certainly Chara's getting up there, and they've got injury problems. Dougie Hamilton's now out probably for the rest of the regular season.
When does he become
loss?
When does he become Doug Hamilton?
Never. Never. He's Dougie.
Like he's 60, a hockey
he's
player.
Dougie? No, even if he was Doug now in the locker room, he'd be Dougie.
Yeah, that's
so
good.
That's just the way hockey works. You kind of gotta roll with it. But Ottawa's been riding Andrew Hammond, but it's not just him. Like, they've been playing some decent hockey. Their possession numbers are pretty good over the last little while. Certainly not great compared to some of the real playoff teams, but they're doing it with more than him. So if Craig Anderson has to step in here and make a couple of starts, they still got a shot, especially with Boston really, really scuffling.
What about in the Western Conference? Because the Calgary Flames throughout the entirety of the regular season had been the story of the Western Conference, how they were expected to be right in there among those Connor McDavid teams. And they've been in a playoff spot for a long, long swath of the regular season, right now on the outside looking in, but right in there with the Kings. And it's going to come down to the final days of the regular season to decide that. They are...
No, it won't.
Okay, you think it's...
No, it won't.
They're just going to lose every game from now on out?
The Kings are beating the Flames. The Kings are getting in the playoffs. Calgary's not a playoff team. The Los Angeles Kings would be, even now, if they snuck into the playoffs in the eighth spot, they'd be one of my four top picks to win the Cup.
Well, I mean, everybody said that. And they do have a game in hand and a point in hand on the Calgary Flames.
They're getting in.
And you know what? Okay, I guess, should we end the discussion there?
No, I'm just telling you, you guys can fight over it. I'm just telling you right now that the Los Angeles Kings are in the playoffs. You can yap about me next week on the radio station when I'm not here, if they're trailing Calgary by then, but they outclass the Flames in every aspect.
Well, and this is, I mean, we have a couple
gamble
of years.
Like an irresponsible amount of money on it or something? Is that why you're so shit?
No comment.
We've been here before with the Kings, right? Like, they were the 8th seed when they won their first cup. And that was late season swoon was a big part of it. But they have no problem going into the playoffs as this team that just barely snuck in. And it looks like they're going to do it again. What does it mean for Calgary, though? If they, you know, throughout the entire season, they overplayed expectations and they outperformed the secondary numbers. What if they finish on the outside looking in?
Worst case scenario, because you're not a good team when you really look at it, and you're not going to get a good draft pick because you just missed the playoffs. So that is worst case scenario. In this league, like, you want to either be in the playoffs or you want to be, like, so bad that it's, like, hurts to watch you, because that's how you get better.
Now, I will say the difference between the NHL and the NBA, in which, you know, in the NBA that getting one guy there at the top of the draft every year, that can change your franchise. You can build an entire franchise around that. Now, this year, there is a guy like that in Connor McDavid, and maybe two with Jack Eichel. But in general, in hockey, having the 12th overall pick versus the second or third overall pick, it's a disadvantage, but it's not like good, really good franchise-building players are found in between 10 and 20 in the draft, like, every single year.
I mean, you see what the Leafs did for so many years, where they would either, like, just miss the playoffs, right? Like, how many years were we coming down to the end of
this? But the Leafs also made some really bad picks in those years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You have to have absolutely great scouts and good development, and you have to have good player identification, and how much faith do you have?
Aren't the Flames in a totally different scenario, though, because they didn't add pieces at the deadline? If anything, they took a few pieces away. They know that they're not cup contenders, even if they make the playoffs. So if they do finish as that team, the first team on the outside of the playoffs looking in, now, while it's not a great spot to be as far as the draft is concerned, although they do get a 1% chance at Connor McDavid, let's not forget about that.
You're telling me there's a chance.
So there is a chance. It's not like they've, you know, dealt pieces away to try and make the playoffs and came short of their goal. They are still on track and look like they're doing a pretty good job of building a young nucleus.
They are. I mean, when I said that this wasn't a playoff team and they have no chance against the Kings, that's one thing. But what Calgary's done this season has been really good compared to where they were a year ago. You would consider this easily a win season for them. They've developed some young pieces. Johnny Gaudreau opened a ton of eyes. He's probably going to win the Calder Trophy. Until Giordano got hurt, they had the Giordano-TJ Brody pairing, which was one of the top five defense pairings in the league. There are some pieces there. So I don't think you worry too much about the Flames going forward. They need more pieces. But they've taken really solid steps.
Any takers on Phil Kessel and David Booth getting into it at practice? Anybody care?
No.
All right.
I couldn't care less. Good, bad, I don't know. Whatever.
It's nice to see Phil Kessel care about something.
That stuff happens. Like, it used to happen a lot more than it does now.
And if it happened on a winning team, this would be a sign of how tuned in they were and how fired up they were and everything. It happened on a losing team, so it's a sign of a toxic dressing room. You write it how you want to write it.
It's a battle drill, right? And if you're battling in the corner and someone does something you don't like, you go back at him and it just escalates.
Yeah, no punches thrown even. It looked pretty, you know,
it's pretty tame.
Yeah.
It's a little hugging drill.
Over the last week, the Buffalo Sabres and Arizona Coyotes needed overtime. Fans cheered the Coyotes' goal in overtime. They booed every time the Sabres scored in that game. And there were some writers from Buffalo and some bleeding hearts that were upset about it. I had no problem with it. Any takers on that? Anybody have a problem with the Buffalo fans booing their own team?
Zero problem.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks, right?
It sucks like, for those
if
players.
If you're a kid, like, think about, like, the 6-year-old, 7-year-old kid who's growing up in Buffalo, right? Like, and you
well, go, it sucks for that kid anyway.
You go, yeah, right, a lot sucks for that kid, it's true.
Smell the tire fire every day.
It's kind of the cherry on top of the suck Sunday is that, like, he has to show up to cheer his team, and he just loves the Sabres, and he comes in, and this entire crowd is, like, booing his team, and then you're the dad who has to explain to the kid why everybody is booing his favorite team.
NHL did this to themselves.
Well, son, right? Let me tell you about these lottery odds we got going here.
We've got
here.
This ridiculous system in place.
It is a ridiculous system. We could probably take the 2 hours coming up with systems of our own, but we will not do that because I feel like I do that every week around this time. All right, when we come back, though, the Raptors beat the Lakers yesterday at the Air Canada Center, final throwback Friday, or whatever they call it, 20th anniversary of the Raptors. So they will finish top four in the Eastern Conference, although they could not have home court advantage in the opening round of the playoffs. And it looks like they will play the Washington Wizards. Talk about the Raptors, their recent play, and maybe the future of Dwayne Casey as well, coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Arden Zwelling on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like arena football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
This could be the thing that could, you know, push us over the hump and give us what we need again and get our swag back. That's all it is. And, you know, once we get back on track, we're going to be right where we left off.
I was DeMar DeRozan after yesterday's 94-83 win for the Raptors. Man, I hope that's, I mean, beating a 19-52 Lakers team, I hope that's not what you needed to get over the hump. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Arden Zwelling and Jordan Heath Rawlings. Yes, the Raptors do beat the Lakers. Lakers are terrible. The second worst team in the Western Conference. Raptors clinched the Atlantic Division, though. They are 43-30. The Atlantic Division is going to get tougher in coming years, you would think. Can't be as bad as it's been the last few years. But back-to-back division titles, it's something. It's better than not winning the division the last couple of years.
Yeah, they'll hang banners for that, too. It'll be great.
Absolutely. Right next to the Bon Jovi banner. So that's good. The Raptors have not looked great, though. Ever since that win in Atlanta after the All-Star break, really, that was the last time this Raptor team looked great. And they have some wins. I mean, they beat the Sixers, they beat Miami, beat Indiana, Minnesota, and now the Lakers and the Knicks. Those are all the wins the Raptors have picked up since the All-Star break, combined with that Atlanta win. They haven't looked like the same team early this season. And part of that is injuries. Kyle Lowry missed yesterday's game as well after trying to come back against the Bulls and lasting not too long before he had to go back out. So overall, the sentiment around Raptor fans, I think, is pretty low. Especially considering where expectations were, where fan interest was when they were starting the season 13-2. Arden, where is this team? I mean, are they just another also-ran in the Eastern Conference? Are they in that echelon just below Cleveland and Atlanta? Where are they in their development?
I don't know. They're the best Raptors team I've ever seen in my life. Probably the best Raptors team
you
anyone
think so? They're
has
better
ever seen.
They're better than that Vince Carter back rimming against the Sixers team.
They got a better record, you know?
I know, but to me, that team was much better.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, they had Vince Carter.
Yeah.
Vince Carter in his prime. That was a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, Kyle Lowry in his prime. DeMar DeRozan in his prime.
Well, I got Kyle Lowry in
Jonas
a back brace right
Valanciunas
now.
In his prime. You got Bruno Caboclo dropping the ball out of bounds in garbage time. What more do you want? Gravis Vasquez
some
running
wins
the court.
Against some plus 500 teams was, down the stretch here would be nice. That's what I want.
I've never seen someone so rattled as Bruno Caboclo last night, I think it was, or two nights ago, when he came in for, like, garbage time.
Last night.
Legitimately just dropped the ball out of bounds, like, with nobody guarding him. Oh, it was good. That kid. The thing is, like, everybody cheers so loudly for Bruno, right?
And human he comes victory in, cigar.
And people go nuts that Bruno's in there. They go nuts. And he might not be that good. Like, he might not be very good.
He might not be the Brazilian Kevin Durant?
No, he might not.
He's famously 2 years away.
2 years away.
There you go. See, it sucks that it was just a random announcer who was saying that at the draft, a random pundit, and it's going to stick with that kid until he makes it or doesn't make
just
it.
I've never seen so much pressure on a man of very little talent, it seems.
And so much pressure with nothing at stake. And at that point, it's one of those things where you wonder, like if you're a kid from Brazil and you're trying to adapt to the NBA and you've been brought in and everything, and all of a sudden these fans are screaming, even though you think the game is over and like you're just here to learn and everything. And what the heck is going on?
It must be so confusing.
It must be really confusing.
And then you got to go practice against like James Johnson, who is like one of the baddest dudes live and is like up in your grill like
blood
all
sport.
Day. Can you imagine how I would be rattled too? Oh my God. I hate when players like become gimmicks. Like it's like the Munenori Kawasaki thing, right? Yeah. Like when players become like gimmicks for fans. Like I get that it's fun, right? Like cheer for him, like have fun. But it's like a guy with like a life and like a brain and a head. This is a guy who has to live this.
I think he would take it over where he was a year ago today.
Brazil's
right?
A lovely place.
He was doing some practicing with the Ryerson team too during the season, which has got to be a much better fit for him at this point in his career.
He doesn't even play when they send him to the D League. He doesn't even play there. Like he doesn't even come up. You know what I mean? Like he comes off the bench at the end of the game in D League.
Yeah, well, and the D League it's a misnomer to call it a developmental league because you got a lot of veterans there trying to work their way back to the NBA, trying
and they
to
do
get
it
theirs.
By beating the crap out of kids in the paint and everywhere else that they can.
Right, and there is pressure on him because he plays once every 2 weeks, right, for a minute and a half. So there's pressure to jack it up as soon as he gets it.
I saw him come in like a week ago and like Quincy Acey like just sunned him, right?
Yes.
Like just ruined him. And this is like a scrub in the NBA who just
Quincy Acey was the guy that had his spot on his spot at the bottom of the bench last year.
Oh, just like out-muscled him to every, like just taught him a lesson.
Welcome to the big boys.
Yeah, but we're like at the end of the season now, right? Like you've been in
he's not supposed to be
a
contributor. Like it's a learning
process.
If
you haven't developed at all in this entire season, like what has been happening
I don't think you or me or anybody who's not watching practice has any idea if he's developed.
The guy's
you're not
19
looking at
years
that,
old.
Yeah, you're not looking at that minute and a half of a game and be like, wow, he's really come a long way.
It's in practice
that he's showing. Andrew Wiggins.
He's 20 and
Andrew
he's
Wiggins
it.
Is the first overall pick.
Putting up like 20 a night.
Yeah, Andrew Wiggins with the Kansas. Okay, Bruno Caboclo played in the streets of Brazil.
Was he playing in a Brazilian men's league? Those are men he's playing against.
Sure. Okay.
There you go.
I think we've spent altogether way too long on Bruno Caboclo as you try to skirt the question as to where the Raptors are.
The Raptors are a middle of the pack team. It might have been fun earlier this year to get all excited. It might be tempting to get all pessimistic now. It's a weak Eastern Conference. They got a couple of players, and they can make a run as much as anybody else can make a run. But I don't think this is a team that's going to the finals.
They can make a run as much as anybody can make a run.
Oh, anybody in the Eastern Conference. They get hot. They've proven they can beat any team in the East.
It's been so long since they did that.
I know, so you forgot what it feels like when they're hot, but they can do it.
Defensively all season, though, they have been a train wreck. Even when they were winning, even when they were 13-2 to start the season, this was a team that didn't play good defense. And a year ago, second half after they traded Rudy Gay, they were a great defensive team. They went toe-to-toe with who we thought was the best defensive team last year, the Indiana Pacers, and outslugged them. And the Pacers obviously, lost Paul George and fell on their faces a little bit. But that defensive mindset, that team that can grind it out with you, that can pound it out with you in late game possessions, just has not been there all season long.
It's not really a grinding D so much as it is like a scrambling D. Like, you see how they play like that double team, and then you're just, there's, oh, like as soon as there's a pass, there's a Raptor sprinting right to get there. And that's just kind of, that's how they've built the defense. And maybe the league has adjusted to that. And perhaps the Raptors need to adjust back, but maybe leagues have, or maybe teams have figured out that you move the ball well, and you'll find a shot.
Yeah, their spacing's not ideal for sure. I mean, I'm no defensive expert of a coach or anything, but when you're having to race to recover that often, and it just takes three or four crisp passes, and you've got a totally open look.
I feel like the defense is like built on that though. Like, it's built on scramble. Like, they want to be scrambling. They want to be like you create those double teams, and you almost hope the other team makes a mistake in a way.
Well, you touched on something that I think has become the issue here, maybe all season long, but certainly the last month and a half, is maybe the league has adjusted to them, and maybe they haven't adjusted back to the adjustment. And where does that land? For me, it lands on the head coach. And I know Dwayne Casey's a great guy and seems to do every interview, and the media likes him. I've liked my interactions with Dwayne Casey. Is he the greatest coach in the NBA? I would be hard-pressed to say that, yes, he's in the top five coaches in the NBA. And I bet you ask most people in NBA circles, and they would say, no, he's probably in the bottom 15 of head coaches in the NBA. I just think it means something that this team has seemingly not adjusted to an adjustment that the rest of the league has made to them.
Oh, welcome to Toronto, where there's no coach we can't fire as soon as the team doesn't play well. This city,
they're doing the same thing in Washington. They're doing the same thing in plenty of cities around the NBA.
I'm not even speaking about the NBA here. This is the mentality of a city that's lost for too long in too many different ways, and they feel like it must be the guy in charge if their team's not winning. Just wait 3 years from now when the Leaf fans are screaming to fire Mike Babcock because he can't possibly be as good a coach as they thought he was. He must be overrated. Why is the team not winning? Oh, my God, they figured him out.
I hate that argument, though, because it's that you're saying that the head coach does nothing. So then why not have, like, one of those plastic birds that bobs its head into the water on the sideline?
Head coaches in any sport except football are vastly overrated.
Well, look at what's happened in Golden State to the Warriors. All right, they fire Mark Jackson, in comes Steve Kerr. And yes, that was a fringy playoff team last year. It's a generally same roster. Steve Kerr has turned them into the best team in the NBA.
They got a lot of young players who got better.
You ask a lot of people around the NBA, they've changed how things work offensively with that team a whole lot. The systems are entirely different. They're an underrated defensive team, holding opponents to the lowest field goal percentage in the entire NBA. A head coach can affect you. I mean, look at what Budenholzer has done in Atlanta with the Hawks. You can have a head coach totally change the fortunes of your franchise. Now, they can't turn, I don't think anybody was turning the Knicks into the Warriors this year. But
so
I think
Phil Jackson bad. Like, this is the thing: is Phil Jackson's won however many championships?
Yeah, but he's not the head coach of that team.
No, I know, but
he's been
the head coach of teams that have reached the greatest heights and some of the lowest lows back at the end of the Lakers era. And
it's kind of interesting how guys like Derek Fisher and Jason Kidd can go from like playing point guard 1 year to head coach the next.
Right.
What does that say about it?
Yeah.
Well, and Jason Kidd had some speed bumps early in his career. Now he seemingly has figured it out in Milwaukee, yeah. And Derek Fisher is certainly learning on the
years.
Job.
So I mean, how many years for him to become a great head coach?
How many other sports can you do that? Go from being playing the sport, baseball,
you can definitely
to being a head coach or a manager the next year.
You can do it in hockey too. So this is why, hence my theory. In football is a head coach properly valued.
So it doesn't matter. You just need a cheerleader on the
sideline. You need somebody who can manage personalities, who can negotiate things with his players, who players respect and look up to, and who can drop a play.
Beyond that,
it's all guesswork and magic.
How about a guy who draws up a play better than Lou Williams standing at midcourt and jacking it up, pounding the ball for 20 seconds
It would be nice, but I don't think that's the reason. Like, Dwayne Casey's bad plays are not the only reason that this Raptors team is scuffled.
No, of course not.
Because they can't play defense.
But
and
you
I don't
can't
think
dismiss
a new coach,
it. You can't dismiss it and say that it's irrelevant.
I'm not dismissing it. I'm saying firing a coach doesn't fix a bad team.
Maybe he prefers to have one guy doing one. Like, he prefers to have that controlled scenario of Lou Williams is my best one-on-one guy. Let's set him up one-on-one. Let him try to create a shot. Instead of five moving pieces, that's five guys that can fail now instead of just one guy. Maybe he looked at the percentage. Maybe he thinks the percentages are better with the one guy instead of the five.
Well, the numbers would, if he doesn't know the numbers, then that's embarrassing. But yes, since that, it's come out that Lou Williams is the worst shooter in the NBA at the dying seconds of a quarter with the ball in his hands.
That's because he takes heaves. The heaves are factored into there, too, because he gets...
That
he
was
takes,
a heave in Detroit.
I know, but he takes all those no-hope heaves at the end of quarters. They give it to him, and he shoots
it
from half court,
be.
And that
They don't
counts.
Have to be no-hope heaves. They have the ball with 10 seconds of time, and they pass it around. They don't pass it around. They pounds the ball for 8 seconds before throwing it up with
I'm
a second
also
ago.
Including all those... 2 seconds left in a quarter, you inbound it to Lou Williams and he shoots it from half court at the end of the second quarter. That all factors into the shooting percentage is all I'm saying.
Okay.
The guys who take the end of quarter shots always have the lowest shooting percentages.
Okay, enjoy your time on the island, the only guy defending the Lou Williams last second quarter
I'm not defending
shot.
Those last second run-up drawn plays that seem to be try to beat a guy one-on-one. Those are terrible.
But that's not the only thing we're talking about. We're talking about Dwayne Casey. We're also talking about minutes distribution and... Jonas Valanciunas plays into it a little bit. James Johnson definitely plays into it. He's been curiously stable to the bench at times when they've needed better defensive play. Now, he was outstanding yesterday against the Lakers. Now, I know he's kind of maybe been instrumental in getting Kyle Lowry to the place that he's at right now. I'm just saying, Arden, is it not worth discussing that that this team might be better off if it wants to take that next step towards not being an also-ran or one of those guys, one of those teams jammed into the middle of a soft underbelly Eastern Conference, if it wants to take that next step, maybe it's another head coach that needs to step in.
I think that a coach can, when you look at how much a coach can affect your win-loss total in the NBA, and we were talking plus or minus 3-4, maybe. I mean, I think that players, that's what you need. You need good, the Raptors, you know, they have some good players. They don't have that like that star power, which is what has always been kind of the thing with this team. Is they don't have, since Vince Carter left, they haven't had that dude. And that, they don't have that right now. Like Kyle Lowry maybe can be that dude. Maybe.
They have two all-stars.
Yeah?
They have two all-stars. They have Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan. DeMar DeRozan was an all-star last year and Kyle Lowry this year.
The amount they have to lean on those guys, they break down. Kyle Lowry right now broken down.
Maybe
DeMar DeRozan missed time with a groin injury.
Well, maybe that's part of the coaching as well. Maybe this team doesn't have the worst big man inside players in the NBA, and maybe they should be taking more shots. Because you look at Amir Johnson and Jonas Valanciunas, they're in top 10 in field goal percentage in the NBA. But the amount that they're used on the offensive side of the ball is minimal.
When you got to protect Amir Johnson because he's playing with bad ankles, and you can't rely on him to be one of your go-to scorers. It's just not going to happen. I agree with you that Valanciunas should be used more at the end of games. Like we talked about earlier, I like to throw guys into the fire, so just give him more run. But,
well, and especially if you've decided that, and you know, it's fair to say that the rest of the season doesn't mean all that much now that you've clinched the division. Now would be the time to give a run to guys and see what you have and understand what your team is going into the playoffs, where you're likely going to face the Washington Wizards. How do we like that matchup? Because it looks like, barring kind of craziness down the stretch, the Raptors are going to play the Wizards in the opening round of the playoffs. They've owned them during the regular season. I mean, you know what? Both teams have kind of had similar problems recently. The Wizards have lost to the Sixers. They've been a lousy team the last couple of months as well. Is that something you get excited about? It's certainly better than playing like the Bulls, who you haven't beaten this season.
I think you're gonna have like a winnable series in the first round, whether it's Washington or Milwaukee. Like that's a team that you'd like, you can walk into with confidence saying, all right, yeah, we could do this. It's gonna be the second round that's gonna be, I wouldn't be surprised if the Raptors made it out of the first. I think it's the second round that'll be
yeah,
the
I think
challenge.
They're gonna, I think they can win the first round, and then you're looking at a much tougher matchup against teams who've frankly, on paper and to the eye test right now, look much better than the Raptors.
But isn't that all gravy once you get to the second round anyways? Isn't the goal of this team just to win a first-round series and then, you know, the balloons fall from the sky and confetti shot up because they've accomplished their goal, they've won another division title, they've won a first-round series?
And then we give Dwayne Casey Coach of the Year, right, Ben?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
This is the best Raptors team there's ever been, ever. And everyone wants to change it. There's never been a better Raptors team.
And now we want to fire the guy who turned the team around in 3 years coming here. He turned them from a no-hope team right? to a team that's going to have more wins than any other team in franchise history. But now in order to take the next step, we got to fire him.
Lou Williams, great shooter, found money in that trade. And now you want to run him out of town. Unbelievable. Shaking my damn head.
Oversimplifying it a little bit.
SMH, my friend.
But honestly, if they win the first round series against the Wizards, is that it? I mean, is that mission accomplished? You're not going to do anything. I mean, you're not going to tear things down. I don't know if you're tearing things down either way. It's going to be an interesting offseason.
I mean, you got to play the second round, and I'm not saying they're necessarily going to lose.
Well, they're not beating Cleveland or Atlanta. Well, maybe they could be. I mean, they've owned Atlanta this regular season, but they're not beating Cleveland or Chicago, likely, the way they played them this season.
Oh, I think they could beat Chicago. I'm not saying I would pick them, but I'm saying I would give them a fighting chance. I would give them a fighting chance against Atlanta. I would not give them a fighting chance against Cleveland.
You could beat Chicago for three quarters.
Yeah.
If the game ends at three quarters,
you're great. If only Jonas was playing the fourth. No, I don't think that. I think Cleveland is by far the worst matchup for them just because, well, Cleveland's the worst matchup in the East for anybody because when those three guys play well, you can't run with them.
Cleveland lost yesterday, but yes, they are quite good and stuff. The Hawks have clinched first overall seed in the Eastern Conference, but Raptors now kind of playing out the stretch. They have a two-game lead on Washington for home court in that opening round series, but I think they have the tiebreaker because they own the season series against them, and they're only a game back in Chicago now for third in the East as well. So, yeah, lots still kind of to play for down the stretch, but as far as a playoff spot and the division title, it's all wrapped up. When we come back, get into some of the offseason NFL happenings. Adrian Peterson wants out of Minnesota. I don't know, sounds a little easier said than done. Also, guys we've heard of in the past year, along with Adrian Peterson and Ray Rice, with some disciplinary problems and domestic violence problems that are pretty horrible. And yeah, there's no video like Ray Rice, but man, Greg Hardy and Ray McDonald, some awful, awful stuff. And they have jobs. And we'll talk about that. And the Buffalo Bills. How about their offseason? People in Buffalo are excited. They could have Connor McDavid and maybe a team battling with the Patriots in the AFC East. All that and more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Arden Zwelling on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's on Sportsnet.ca right now.
Imagine what it would feel like to be buried alive.
Six boys and one girl were killed during a high school ski trip, swept to their deaths by a massive avalanche.
The darkness, the panic, the slow suffocation. Imagine it. Will Johnson doesn't have to. He lived it. That's because 12 years ago, Johnson survived one of the deadliest avalanches in Canadian history. In 2003, he was 15 years old when he set out on a backcountry ski trip with his high school outdoor education class.
The tragedy quickly became a wake-up call about backcountry travel and safety. The school made changes to its outdoor education program, and the deaths also had an impact on Parks Canada.
It was just another beautiful day in the Rockies until a massive slide came barreling down from Mount Cheops, swallowing everything in its path.
It was an unimaginable tragedy.
Seven of Johnson's classmates were killed. None of the survivors have spoken publicly about that day until now. Will Johnson breaks the silence to talk about the avalanche and the years he spent dealing with the tragedy.
Fans can find this story and more on Sportsnet.ca. Canada's home for sports news, analysis, videos, and features.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Arden Zwelling. Hey, Steve Nash has officially retired. If it wasn't a surprise, clearly. The guy didn't play at all this season with the Lakers in the back, just eventually giving out. But sad nonetheless, two-time MVP and the greatest basketball player to ever emerge from this country. I mean, there's no question about that, right? I mean, he is the greatest. Two-time MVP. Never won a title, but man, those Suns teams were fun to watch with D'Antoni and maybe a couple of guys that, if they didn't step onto the court in that fracas and get suspended for a game, maybe they beat the Spurs, and maybe we are talking about a team that won a championship. But as it stands, they were just a fun team to watch, and they will remain that way and didn't win a title. But Steve Nash, there were conversations had, and so much of my sporting experience is now based on Twitter, but it was on Twitter where there were people arguing the impact that his career had on Canadians and whether it was comparable to Wayne Gretzky or the greatest hockey players of all time. Jordan, are we overrating, underrating the career of Steve Nash?
Well, if you're comparing him to Wayne Gretzky, you are both overrating the career of Steve Nash and severely underrating the career of Wayne Gretzky. It's not a comparison. I love Steve Nash. Those teams were fantastic to watch. But when you start getting into the greatest Canadian athlete ever and you have, you know, Wayne Gretzky and Gordie Howe and guys who, you know, years in some respects, decades in other respects, are still mentioned alongside the absolute legends of the sport, it's not a fair comparison.
Well, it's not a fair comparison in the aspect that the machinery exists for a Canadian to become Wayne Gretzky, to become Sidney Crosby, where at the time, and now it's definitely different now that the Raptors are celebrating their 20-year anniversary, but at the time, there was nothing for Steve Nash to hang his hat on. There was really, really a limited amount of resources in this country to get him where he wanted to go, to get him to Santa Clara and then eventually to the NBA and a two-time MVP and headed to the Hall of Fame.
Sure, but those are all caveats, you know? And if you want to put caveats on the story that Steve Nash is the most inspirational long odds story of a Canadian athlete risen to MVP status, then I will give him that award. You
is
know
there an
what?
Award for that?
Yeah, well, there should be, because clearly then we'd have something to give to Steve Nash instead of taking it away from Wayne Gretzky. I'll also say this about Steve Nash being the athlete of the year for Canada. We do this all the time in that we give our athlete of the year awards to people who we think deserve it because their stories are inspiring and they won a silver medal at the Olympics or they won a tennis tournament or whatever. Meanwhile, our greatest athletes are dominating one of the major four sports leagues. And we're just like, oh, yeah, Sidney. Well, he only led the scoring race by 15 points this year. So maybe we'll give it to some other.
Sometimes we give it to a car, too. So, yeah. Occasionally.
You'd have to have a whole separate one for hockey then. Because other, if you want to do it that way, it's be a hockey player every year.
But no, we wouldn't. I mean, you could have made a case for Eugenie last year based against any hockey player.
She won a tennis tournament or whatever, as you said.
She went to the finals at Wimbledon and won several tennis tournaments. So, you know, that's an achievement.
Story changes.
And again, if Steve Nash, you know, in the years that he won the MVP, he would absolutely be in competition for that. But it's more every year. I can pretty much promise you that Canada has, you know, three of the top five hockey players on the planet, and usually number one. And usually it's not that close. So,
say something nice about Steve Nash. My God.
Great hair.
I
loved watching
deep
those
voice.
Teams. Those
very
teams,
raspy, deep
those teams
voice.
Were fantastic. Wow. And there was a great book written about it. Jack McCallum wrote that 7 Seconds or Less book, which if you've never read it, anybody listening, one of the best sports books you'll ever read. Steve Nash, starring role.
Who had more of an impact on the glut of NBA players from this country, well, in the NBA and headed to the NBA seemingly, and it seems like every year there's more and more, and Andrew Wiggins is likely going to be the rookie of the year. Was it Steve Nash that had a greater impact, or the fact that the Raptors have now existed for 20 years?
I think it's probably the Raptors more so than Steve Nash.
Vince Carter.
Yeah, honestly, it was Americans who had the biggest. Vince Carter, T-Mac, like JYD,
right? Stoudemire.
JYD.
JYD got in
there. I'll throw him in there. When you think of like Raptors from that era, JYD sticks out to me, man.
JYD brought the
Jamario Moon.
Yeah, he brought the Canadian hockey mentality to the basketball court.
Sure.
But those were
the. Love those grinders.
Yeah, it's like guys were buying Raptors gear. I don't know how many guys were buying Steve Nash, you know, Suns jerseys, whoever he was on at the time, like, or Mavericks, whoever. Like, I think guys were buying Raptors stuff.
It's kind of sad, though, the way things ended for Steve Nash, right? That he didn't win a title, that some people look at that one MVP award and say he probably shouldn't have won it, that he never got to see it through with Dirk, that Dirk did eventually win that title.
Yeah.
And he has to, every time he sees Dirk, he has to look at that ring and look at his own hand and see, you know, there's nothing there.
He definitely does that too. He looks at Dirk's ring and then he stares down at his own finger like you just did. It's like, where's my ring? Yeah. Oh yeah, I never won.
Yeah. I mean, there's been great players that have never won titles before. I mean, Dan Marino, Charles Barkley. Vince Carter? He's still playing. Could still win.
Yeah,
Grizzlies could win it all this year. And he's been instrumental coming off the bench there. Does that taint his legacy at all?
Taints his this great man? The best basketball player to ever come out of Canada. Going to go to the Hall of Fame.
Well,
he's
some
tainted.
People, well, some no.
the guys around
okay,
him weren't
that great.
Maybe
taint isn't the right word.
Tainted.
But
he's no longer the greatest athlete in Canadian history anymore.
Sorry,
he's been tainted.
Steve. Sorry, bud.
Is it on the second paragraph of his NBA story? Because, a lot of people talked about those Suns teams, and yes, they were great 7 seconds or less, and the offense was unbelievable, but some people said that you can never win a title that way, and they never did, and certainly there were circumstances maybe outside of their control with the suspensions, but people said Mike D'Antoni, he can never win an NBA title. Hasn't happened yet. He's not in the NBA right now.
How can you fault a guy for not winning a title? It's not a one-man thing. It's a team thing. You cannot fault one man for not getting it done.
Somebody. Who are you going to blame?
You. For bringing this up. You're saying his legacy is tainted.
It's the same people that say Peyton Manning's not going to be one of the best quarterback ever because he only won one Super Bowl.
Yeah,
well, he's not the greatest quarterback ever. He's the greatest quarterback ever. He's better than Tom Brady. You believe that too, Arden?
I'm staying out. I'm out of this one.
You think he's better than Tom Brady?
Yes.
Oh my! I feel like you're on an island there.
I really don't think so.
Oh, I would who would you take in a playoff game? Peyton Manning or Tom Brady?
Do I get Bill Belichick as my head coach and the New England Patriots as my team?
Fine. You swap quarterbacks. Keep the same teams exactly as they're constructed. You swap quarterbacks.
I will take Peyton.
I would not. I mean, it's not just the losses. No, it's not just the losses, though, in playoff games, right? It's the performances. It's his individual performances have been very poor in multiple big playoff. Well, every playoff game is big, but in multiple big games as well. In playoff games, and I know he did win a Super Bowl title against a Bears team starting Rex Grossman.
Oh, so the team matters when it's a bad team that he won it against, but the team doesn't matter when it's his team that lost.
I'm just talking about his individual performances in playoff games. He
has a losing
horrible.
Record. It is true. He has a losing record.
And he has been, him in particular, he has been horrible. Whereas Tom Brady has single-handedly won his team playoff game.
I mean, we could argue this for hours. I am not denying that Tom Brady is a fantastic quarterback. I'm just saying that when I call somebody the best quarterback of all time, I'm talking about mechanics, consistency, volume.
There could be this, some kid who never made the NFL who has the greatest mechanics in the world.
And he doesn't have 430
he's the greatest quarterback.
Touchdowns in the NFL.
But you want to take playoffs entirely out of any meaningful evaluation of a player post-career. You want
to
take
that out
of it. How
do you feel about Dan Marino?
He was a great quarterback. I wouldn't call him the greatest quarterback of all time.
But he's one of the absolute greatest quarterbacks, and he never got a title.
And Peyton Manning is absolutely one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time. There's absolutely no way I put him ahead of Tom Brady.
I'm talking about when I watch these guys play quarterback and I watch Peyton Manning do it, I feel like I'm watching somebody who's better than I've ever seen anyone else play the position. That's the only thing I'm putting on there. I'm not putting on team performance, anything like that. I'm overall body of work. Best I've seen. That's all I'm saying.
So you're trying to separate individuals from their team and the outcome on the field. You're just talking about the passes made in the game, and in that respect, he's better than Tom Brady.
Yeah, well, that's how we got onto this discussion, by talking about whether a team performance matters to an overall individual assessment.
So you don't think it matters?
I think you don't judge individuals by their success in a team sport on wins and losses. You can't.
It's not the only thing, but you separate it entirely.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, I don't. Arden, you've been quiet throughout this. Are you just taking it all in, or you just don't have an opinion?
You know, I'm just soaking up the knowledge from you two experts.
I don't know how we ended up on Peyton Manning.
It always ends up there.
Yeah, seriously. How did you get to Peyton Manning from Steve Nash?
I don't know.
Connect those dots for me.
I don't know.
Great players who didn't win as many titles as we thought they should. That's how we got there.
Yeah, or any in Steve's case. So let's talk about the NFL then. If we've gone to Peyton Manning, who we didn't expect to talk about. Adrian Peterson apparently wants out of Minnesota. Doesn't want to be with the Vikings anymore. It's an interesting situation. I mean, Ray Rice doesn't have a job yet either, although Greg Hardy and Ray McDonald now do. I mean, how do we take that? How should we feel about that when we look at that that reality.
I mean, you shouldn't feel happy for these guys who have obviously done some pretty ugly things.
Right.
But you shouldn't be surprised either. It speaks to the nature of the NFL that it is a workman's league, and there will always be work for people who have talent unless, they're barred from playing. And I think that Ray Rice probably just doesn't have enough talent to find a job somewhere, right? He wasn't very good before this incident. He was on the downside of his career. Yeah, and it had gotten significantly worse over the last year before it happened. And meanwhile, Adrian Peterson, I promise you, you know, an equally ugly incident probably, but I promise you that Adrian Peterson will be playing in the NFL next year.
If not in Minnesota, where? How do they resolve this situation? Or will it be in Minnesota?
I don't think it can be at this point, even though the Vikings have kind of said, you're under contract to us for 3 years. Like, we're paying you a heck of a lot of money. It's the richest or second richest running back contract in the league. And he's basically told his agent to tell them, I'm gone. I don't want to play here anymore because of how he feels they treated him when he was going through all his problems. But Minnesota's not willing to just give up on him, because if you're trading a $15 million a year contract in the NFL, you can't get much back for him. They'd
right.
be talking about, topping out at like a second round pick or maybe a player just to get something back and restock the cupboard. And, you know, they don't want to lose him for that. And rightly so, because on a good team, he'd probably be one of the five best backs in football.
Yeah, he's going to get a job. I guess it's yet to be seen whether Ray Rice lands somewhere, but I got to figure he's, you know, top 30 running back in the NFL if he re-enters the NFL right now, although he hasn't done so yet.
Running backs are pretty much worthless now, though, unless you're in the top 15 or 20. So
didn't Ray Rice, he didn't look that good in his last year pre-destroying, ruining his life. Like, he didn't look that great in that for that last year.
Yeah, I don't know if you zoned out for a second, but yeah, we did mention that.
All right, so... Did definitely zone out.
But
yeah.
you would know, right? You would be able to get guy of Ray Rice's talent or better in the draft, and he would cost you way less.
Michael Sam looks like his NFL career is over before it began. Did not perform all that well at the veteran combine, which is a cool thing that, I don't know, this is the first year I realized it existed.
It is the first year.
It is the first
yes.
year. Okay, so that's good.
It never existed before.
Okay, so that's good. I didn't just miss it.
No. It was a sad spectacle, though. You should have missed it.
I don't know, but I kind of like that. I kind of like the Schadenfreudian aspect of it, where you got these guys who were running, you know, 6 second 40s.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. It's just kind of sad to see guys who have, and they're not old men, right? These are like 25, 26 year olds who have played a couple years, found themselves in need of a job, and now they have to go through the combine. And it makes you wonder. Those other guys in the NFL now who have been in the NFL for a few years, like, what would Adrian Peterson's 40 time be now that he's almost 30 years old? I promise you it wouldn't be what it was when he went through the combine.
It's true. So Michael Sam performs poorly, and he says he is open to the CFL. I wonder if his skill set plays in the CFL. What kind of a story would that be in this country, though, Arden, if Michael Sam signs with the Argos tomorrow? I mean, we've seen NFL players come to this country, and it was kind of a big deal.
Is Michael Sam an NFL player?
Right? I mean, he was drafted into the NFL. He was on a practice squad.
Right?
He's a bigger name than a lot of NFLers.
Like,
right?
Why do we talk about Michael Sam? He's an openly gay professional athlete.
Yes.
That's why we talk about him. But
that's
if
right.
he was not openly gay, I mean, nobody talks about him. He's just a scrub defensive end.
He'd still be a good player in the CFL. I mean, he's a defensive player of the year in his conference.
In the SEC.
He's undersized with good tackling, but suspect speed. And he'll play all right in the CFL.
I mean, Cleo Lemon played a whole lot more in the NFL than Michael Sam ever did. But, I mean, there was no fanfare when he ended up in the CFL.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's any question why we would be rooting for him to come up here. And I mean, I would be, if he came to the Owls, I think the Owls own his rights.
Yeah.
I would be rooting for him to succeed. I think we all would. And I think it would be, you know, a nice story after what's kind of been disappointing that he hasn't found work in the NFL.
Is there any question that the only reason he's not in the NFL is because of talent? I mean, is there an undercurrent of maybe teams not wanting the spectacle? It seems, though, especially with the veteran combine stuff, that the skill set just wasn't there.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to obviously, you know, for me or you to make calls on from up here and everything. But certainly nothing about his combine results would suggest that this is a guy with major NFL talent who is being ignored. And, you know, people will people who don't really follow the NFL that closely see like defensive player of the year not getting a sniff in the NFL, but that happens all the time. There's guys whose size and skill sets just don't translate to the next level, and it looks like he's one of them. What interested me more about Michael Sam was him coming out and saying that gay NFL players have reached out to him,
yeah,
and that there's a lot of them, and that they've gotten in touch with him and told him not to give up. And to me, that's a nice story, and I wish those guys, you know, felt like they could come out and support Michael Sam publicly.
And I wonder if this story, you know, if Michael Sam had made a team and was playing in the NFL right now, I wonder if it's a little more likely that those guys would have come out. Does this hurt? Yeah, you know, the ability for a gay athlete in the NFL to come out now that Michael Sam failed. His NFL career never got off the ground.
I don't know. We're moving towards an era and a place where it's going to be okay, I think.
Okay,
it's
it hasn't happened yet.
I know. I said we're moving towards it.
Okay.
It's a very difficult thing to do in that environment to come out as gay, because there are a lot of, bigoted ideas that still get passed around in locker rooms. If you spend any amount of time in a locker room as a reporter, like, you see it and you hear it. Like,
yeah.
It's a very difficult environment to come out in. So I wouldn't want to get to a place where we're like trying to push people to come out and say like, why haven't you come out yet? This has hurt, you know, this has hurt their ability to come out, this and that. I mean, it's a personal choice for every single person, and that's not something that I would want to force upon someone.
But I think it's more helpful rather than us saying to people, athletes who are still in the closet, that, you know, they should be coming out and why aren't they coming out? I think it's more helpful for us to encourage other athletes to be openly supportive of it when it does happen. Like when Andrew Luck last year said, you know, I would be absolutely fine if one of my teammates came out, and I want them to feel comfortable around me, and I'm a leader on this team, so I want to make sure everybody has that attitude. That's what gets us there. Not putting it on people who are already in an uncomfortable situation to put themselves out there more.
But the fact that we can ask the question, is it just Michael Sam's skill set that's keeping him out of the NFL? And the fact that he never did play a game in the NFL, now it might not be the case, but the fact that we can even ask the question, has that maybe put a damper on somebody who was thinking about actually coming out and being that first player to actually play in the NFL as an openly gay athlete?
I don't think that you can't put yourself in that hypothetical person's mind space, right? Like that's impossible to do. I don't think that you'd need like one kind of, I don't know, what's the word for it? Like one leader. Or
a trailblazer?
A trailblazer, right? Like, I don't think it takes one person. It takes a culture change. It takes a culture change. That's what it takes.
I'll tell you the one thing that will be that Michael Sam showed us that I think will be fantastic to see when somebody comes out and makes the NFL and plays well is that person's jersey will sell like hotcakes.
Yeah.
And that's a big step, you know, that
Michael Sam made plenty of money without playing in the NFL.
And his jersey sold, and he never played a snap. And, you know, that's an important step to take where it's looked at as something that's not just a personality thing, but that not only would your team not have to worry about be punished financially or anything for that, but that people are ready for it. That's how people who are fans show that they're ready for it.
It's a shame, though, that he never did get to play a single down. It was a last-round draft pick. Ended up as a cut last second before the regular season for the Rams, ends up on the Cowboys taxi squad. And it would have been nice just to see one down, you know, for him to go to the Jaguars or something. I mean, the Jaguars that they never signed have been playing him for a down.
He doesn't want that. That's tokenism. And I don't think he would want that. I wouldn't want to see that. I want to see Michael Sam come up to the CFL now and be a football player and win a Grey Cup. I forget all the rest of the noise. He wants to play football somewhere. Let's get him on a stage where he can show off his talents and play football and win.
Hopefully it happens with the Montreal Alouettes. Thanks a lot for this, gents. I really enjoyed it. Coming up, I've got a little 20-minute edition of Sportsnet today as we get you set for Blue Jays baseball on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Arden Zwelling. I'm Ben Ennis on the Sportsnet Radio Network.